Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Now, in this episode, I speak to Monsoon Pabrai, who, if that name sounds familiar to any of you, is the daughter of legendary value investor Monish Pabrai. And Monsoon grew up around a lot of really well-known investors, not just her dad, but also the likes of Guy Speer, Li Lu, Francis Chow, Prem Watsa. She met Warren Buffett at the Buffett lunch that Monish Pabrai and Guy Speer bid on back in 2007. And since that time, she's gone on to become a really good investor in her own right. She has worked in a couple of different analyst roles, including one where she interviewed hundreds of different management teams in India, and she has just recently launched her own fund as well. So I believe this is the very first podcast that Monsoon has done, so it was really cool to kind of get her on the show and also put to her a lot of audience questions that I collected over on Twitter in the last week or so as well. So I really hope you enjoy this episode, but for now, let's roll this one with Monsoon. All right, Monsoon Pabrai is on the podcast. I believe this is your very first investing podcast, so I appreciate you taking the time and thanks for joining me. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to have you on here. We had a lot of really good, like a really good response on Twitter, lots of good questions coming through, and interested to dig into your kind of journey into investing. Obviously, you have a reasonably well-known surname in the value investing world. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what your journey was like growing up around pretty well-known investors and kind of getting into the investing business yourself, having just started your own fund?
Yeah, so the main investor I hung out with most of the time was my dad. I think he's different from other value investors and other professionals in that he brought my sister and I around a lot with him. So I met a bunch of his investor friends when I was young. And I think the most unique part about it was probably going over, I mean, he would not do this all the time. And he really only started doing it after maybe we were like 10 or 11, but he would go into like some kind of detail on business models of businesses he was looking at. And I remember like we would be out for dinner with Mediterranean food and he would kind of work through the model, and I'm like 13. So I would say that was probably the most unique part, is just having that experience. But the first experience I can think of, I was 8 and my younger sister was 7. And he really wanted us to pick our first stock, and kind of just asked us very simple, like he really didn't cover circle of competence, but he was addressing it like in where we hang out and things we look at, what is something we would see around for the next 3, 5, 10 years. And as an 8-year-old, you really can't, that's a really hard question, a really hard question. So I actually answered Target and my sister answered Disney. And so he bought one stock of each for us, put it on the wall with like a cute frame, my first stock, like ABC. And my younger sister did better. Disney performed better from 2003 to now. So that's the very first experience. And he was, I think really what we talked about, if anything with investing, was just a bit the business models. And I'm like very thankful and grateful for that experience.
Hmm. Do you remember much of your dad's kind of entrepreneurship journey, or was he pretty well into kind of the hedge fund money management world?
I think the fund, I think it started in 99 and I was born 95. So really I was 5 years old when the fund started. I just knew both my parents were entrepreneurs, and just my entire life, especially with my dad, it was just the fund.
Yeah, very cool. And I guess one of the things that I don't want to make this episode completely about your dad, but we'll get away from that shortly, but one of the things that he and Guy Speer are really well known for is obviously bidding on the Buffett lunch back in 2007, I think it was, and looking through some of the photos that are out there from that lunch, a very young monsoon papayas in a lot of those photos as well. So do you remember much from meeting Warren Buffett and going to that lunch?
I remember almost everything with it. That was and I think we were the first kids to ever attend the lunch, which was awesome, probably unheard of. I actually don't even know if in the lunches after us, any investor brought their kids along. And guys, kids were way too young. They were really small then. And they did the best thing. Guy and my dad sat, my sister and I, on either side of Buffett actually for the full lunch. What I do remember is my mom had us, the lunch was 2007, and it almost happened like a full year later. So that for that full year, on the weekends, we would study and learn about Buffett's life. We created a scrapbook on like every chapter of his life, and we gave it to him. And he gave us M&Ms with his face on them. He was awesome. He just answered questions. He included us in the conversation. I think it was fun for him to have us there. And then the most notable thing I remember as a 12-year-old, he told my sister and I, the most important decision you make is who you marry. And that's had some, I'm still single, but that's had some impact on, I think, both of us, on just being very careful about who you pick.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah. And if I recall correctly, he brought along a few gifts for you guys as well.
Yes, he brought, there were really pretty blue M&Ms with his face. And I think maybe there was a Coca-Cola bottle. And my dad asked us not to eat the M&Ms, and we ate every single one. So there's nothing from that. So yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, very cool. Have you had much to do with Warren Buffett since that lunch, or that was really it?
No, that was really it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that that lunch sort of opened up the doors to meeting the likes of Charlie Munger, Lee Lu. I know from the Berkshire meeting earlier this year, you put up photos with both of those guys, I think. And I see on your Twitter, you've also got pictures with people like Francis Chow and Prem Watsa, I believe, from the Fairfax meeting. Yes. How's it been kind of getting right into that circle and meeting some of these like all-time greats?
They're all just really kind people. And I think a lot of them have seen me go from some kind of interest with an internship to actually being an analyst and then now raising my fund. And with Raising the Fund, they're, I think, just as excited as I am. And, you know, they give some tips that are very kind. I think Francis gave me a really cute tip in Toronto. He told me that you're either going to be a rifle shooter or a, what's the other kind of gun? Or like a
shotgun?
You're either going to have like a portfolio with a bunch of stuff or like a really concentrated portfolio of a few names. And it's really where your personal comfort is with that risk profile. I was like, thank you for like just saying it that way for me. Mm-hmm. It's nice to hear that from someone who's raised a huge fund and run it for a long time. Yeah. Getting the access to them and being able to talk to them is awesome. I would never abuse that. So I just try to be respectful. So if I'm with my dad in any meeting or hanging out by them, I actually don't say much. I'm just kind of listening. It's already just so exciting to be there. But every now and then I'll chime in and say something that's, I think, relevant. So yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. Did you always feel like you were likely to go into investing as a career, or did you think that you would go down another path?
I wanted to be an attorney. And specifically a judge, I think, until my sophomore year of college. I went to UC Berkeley and I joined the Berkeley Investment Group. I think just pitching a company and going through it was pretty, I think I started investing on my own around 15. And then just at 19, I pitched MasterCard to Berkeley Investment Group, and they accepted me for like a semester internship. And then it just kind of became way more exciting. And I saw how much almost fun and easier it was for me compared to my peers. It just made a lot of sense. And I think it's because just like growing up around business models being mentioned all the time. So yeah, So I think around 19 is when I was like, this is something kind of interesting. And that's when I first brought up to my dad, I think this could be something I would want to do.
What was his reaction?
He was excited, kind of took on like a little bit more of a mentorship role in terms of career. I mean, no matter what career I was going to go into, he's a great career strategist for myself and my cousins and my sister. So he was always kind of involved professionally in what I was doing. But I think it was just extra exciting for both of us that I had a keen interest in it. And I think then I interned at UCLA Endowment. And while I was there, I read a lot of articles and a lot of letters from investors that actually you can't really find on the internet. And that really opened the door. And I wrote kind of like my first letter to partners when I was 19. And I mailed a copy of it to my dad. And that was in LA. He was living in Irvine at the time. I came home for the weekend. And he pulled up his first letter he ever wrote, 94, 95. It is not on the internet what he wrote. And we both agree our first versions they're not publishable. But he showed me what he had done out of excitement the first time, and he was really excited. Then we really both took it seriously. I mean, we ran caliper tests on myself and just kind of checked that this was something I was really interested in. And then it just became an outpour of like book recommendations. So it kind of then I think the more of a mentorship role took place then.
Yeah, very cool. I'm really keen to get into a little bit on investment strategy and that type of thing. We've got lots of questions in that area as well. But maybe tell us a little bit about like your kind of study education. I believe you worked in at least a couple of different analyst roles before starting your fund. I guess what's your journey into the money management business been like?
I joined Berkeley Investment Group. They have a value investing course that they teach that's
Oh,
10
cool.
weeks, so it's like 2 hours a week. That was pretty fun. And then after that, I worked at UCLA Endowment both my summers, sophomore and junior year summer. And this is actually a recommendation to anyone in school. If your winter break is more than 3 weeks, you should do a winter internship. And just so I did 2 weeks extra at the endowment. It was just like a great experience. I actually came back to them when I was about to graduate, going into my senior year, and asked if they would hire me. They said, no, you should probably go do some equity research. I said, okay, sounds good. And then I told my dad, I was like, I'm going to apply for a job in equity research. And he just said, okay, do you want me to email people? I was like, no, the last name is enough. Like, it's enough. It's more than enough. I really just kind of want to get it on in my own head, on my own merit. And then he asked if he could get involved in the process of getting the job. And I said, of course, I would love to have you involved in that. Created a spreadsheet of about 400 hedge funds in the US, California, New York, Massachusetts, Illinois. I wrote one stock pitch on a company, Dillard's. And mailed that in the mail. If you've ever heard of a function called mail merge on like Word or Excel, it's your best friend when you're sending mass letters out. I had 400 letters out, four interviews, zero job offers. And then 3 months later, I increased the list to 750, sent those out, eight interviews actually, and then two job offers. So I've only ever been an employed analyst just at Dalton Investments in Los Angeles. I was on mostly the India team. They sent me to India all the time. I stayed for 3 months and then 2 months, and then I was there every couple months for a few weeks, just meeting hundreds of management teams. That was a great experience. And then after I left that, I worked at a startup. And while I was at the startup, I started the general partnership for my fund with like a little bit of money. Just to kind of build an official track record to see how I would do. Because I think up until then, it was just whatever I had saved, I would put into a name that was interesting at that time. But there was no formal track record build. So, yeah. So,
Yeah.
I was just an analyst once. Yeah.
Very cool. Was there anything in particular that was like your criteria when you were searching through different hedge funds to apply to?
If you've ever seen dataroma.com, every fund there I sent a letter to, because that's just who I was checking whatever, November 14th, February 15th, whatever they buy. So that was I think like 70 names on the list. Otherwise, there's actually a website called Okta Finance or something, and this guy hasn't updated it to since 2016, but it every single hedge fund is there with the AUM, and by the state and by number of employees and number of investors. So I actually pulled that list, and then kind of went was trying to be smart with AUM. Anyone over 10 billion would probably have a formal recruiting process that I actually don't want to go through. And anyone less than 1 or 2 billion probably doesn't want to hire a full-time analyst. That probably actually needs a little bit more additional training. So I really stayed between 2 and 10 billion. And I was pretty certain I didn't want to be in any random state. So I was somewhat focused on geography. But anyone on Dataroma, I didn't care what city they were in, because they're just incredible. So
Yeah. Very cool. I heard you just mention Dillard's kind of in passing there. Can you tell me like what sort of year are we talking when you were doing these applications and pitching Dillard's?
this is not the Ted Weschler Dillard's pick. This was I finished around 2015, 2016 is when I was looking at Dillard's.
Okay.
I think Ted got it in 2020. But I pitched it at around $60 a share, and definitely has topped 300 recently. So that was what I had sent out in the mail.
Very
And
cool.
actually,
Yeah.
what ended up happening was someone got my letter in the mail in New York. He owned Dillard's. He thought my analysis was correct. He scanned everything I sent in the mail to him and sent it to my future employer saying, hey, her analysis is pretty good. She did like a 1 month, I did a 1 month internship in India. She might be decent for the India team. And the guy who got the letter in the mail, this was his mentor he was getting it from. So he also took it seriously.
That's very cool. Yeah, I've just pulled out the Dillard stock price out of curiosity because I have heard of it through Ted Weschler, and it's at about a little under $360 a share for anyone listening that's kind of wondering how that's played out. What was the general kind of investment thesis on that one out of interest?
At that point, it was actually a real estate pick, that the value of their real estate was probably way more valuable than the business, and their leases. So that was kind of the major basis. And I think I had projected that it would go to like $120, $150 per share by 2018 or 2019. And I think that is something you just kind of have to do when you're applying for a job or when you're doing formal research where you have to put a buy price. But I actually don't like putting a buy, or sorry, I don't like putting a sell price after I buy something. I just like checking on it every quarter.
Yeah, cool. So, I mean, tell us a little bit about how would you describe your investment style in a nutshell?
Yeah, so this is honestly borrowed from where I was an analyst, and I love it. There's four main things that we look at. One, is it a good business? Two, what is the margin of safety? Three, how do they allocate capital? And then four, really important for global investing, what's the alignment of interest? Specifically in India, there were so many businesses that were 80% owned by the family. They did not pay themselves a dividend, and the CEO would pay himself like a $10,000 per year salary. And I was like, this is just not correct. So like, you know, to look out for it. So I think, yeah, those are the main four.
Yeah, very cool. And how does that sort of how does that philosophy turn into a portfolio? You know, you mentioned I think Francis's comment to you about you'll be like a rifle approach or a shotgun approach. Where do you kind of fall on that spectrum?
I'm 10 by 10 right now. The fund actually has like a massive cash position, just because it's been less than 2 years and I've been slow to deploy. But the goal is 8 to 12 names, about no more than 10% at cost, for each name, and just kind of see how it goes. So in that way, I do subscribe more to my dad's philosophy. I had been trained under the like 20 name in the portfolio, and I didn't like it. I feel a lot more comfortable with 10.
Is it just that you feel you're spread too thin, or you don't have enough time to, get into 20 businesses in enough detail?
Something's 3% of your portfolio, I just don't see the return being meaningful enough where it's worth that time, for me specifically. But yeah, I mean, it may go up to 15, it may go down to 5, but I think just like starting with 20 is just a little bit tough for me. Yeah,
Yeah, cool.
I really like the 10 by 10 approach. I think it just makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. And you mentioned you spent a fair bit of time in India, meeting
I
a
spent a
lot of
lot of time
different
in India.
management
Yeah.
teams by the sounds of it.
Yeah.
I mean, does the portfolio, or are you open to investing basically anywhere? Do you have holdings in India, for example?
So yeah, the fund is it's a global mandate. It's actually a small percentage in India right now, just because it takes a little bit of time to get access locally in the country, but the moment we have access, I would hope it's like 15 to 20% of the fund, just because that's a country I spend a lot of time in, and a market I think I understand pretty well. But yeah, I think with emerging market investing, you have to spend some amount of time in that country, or you have to have really good friends on the ground to talk to, but it's always worth a visit.
And tell me about your trips to Turkey as well.
Yeah, I just made one trip to Turkey where I accompanied my dad and his team. Tons of fun. I was definitely more of a fly on the wall on that meeting. We met, I want to say, 40 management teams, maybe 30 to 40 management teams. I think both my dad and I agree there's four companies there that were somewhat investable, but there was one I walked out of saying, this is like, you don't even need to do any more work on this. This is like the most obvious pick. And I think my dad looked horrified at me, and he said, you are not my daughter, you are Guy's daughter in the way you pick your businesses. And I told him the other three were, I mean, they're great businesses and they would require a lot more work, but I just like couldn't sit as comfortable with him as he could. I don't even have access to Turkey right now. It was kind of more just like of a learning trip. But it was great. It was great. Just kind of, that was the first time he and I had done, we had done company visits where we were both managing our own fund. Because before his first trip to India, meeting management teams, I actually accompanied him, but I was a senior in college. And so I was applying to Dalton. And he said, hey, you're interviewing for the India team, and I'm thinking of making an India trip. Why don't you come with? So that was the first one. And I was just like a student in college. So it's kind of fun growing up with him, and we're just both investing.
Awesome. And what was it that really got you interested with that one company?
Well, with that honestly, just like really consistent revenues, a really easy business model that you can just understand, almost like a monkey can run it. Not that many people are involved in the operation. That's it. I just think the moment you add like complex layers, different revenue, like lines of business and everything, it gets a lot more complicated. And the more it looks like a lemonade stand in my head, the easier it is to work with valuation and like comfort with different risks the business may take on.
Yeah, cool. And presumably there was like you had an idea of some basic valuation metrics going into that meeting to kind of work off as well.
Before we go into every meeting, we're pretty well prepped on what is the business and what we want to ask. But that we definitely both came out excited, but I was way more excited.
Yeah. Very cool. I want to ask you about a couple of, or one specific investment, if you're willing to share, which is in Moutai. I know both your dad and Li Lu, I think, invest in Moutai. I think Guy Speer in a very small way, but correct me if I'm wrong on that. I understand you also got invested in Moutai and were able to hang on to it quite a bit longer than your dad and Li Lu. Is that accurate?
I do think that's accurate. So yeah, this was I think My dad and I were on our way to India, just honestly for Christmas and the new year. On the way, we stopped in China for maybe 2.5, 3 days. He was doing a talk at Peking. And then we stopped by the Moutai factory with Guy. That was an incredible visit. I had heard about Moutai before, talking about it with my dad. We had gone through like what an incredible moat that business was. I can even say it on the call, but it's only distilled in one location in all of China. It is a state-owned alcohol company. That province, Guizhou, I think 80 or 90% of the revenue that the state gets from local businesses comes from Kuaichiao Moutai. And so I just don't see, I think with a lot of Chinese companies, you see government risk. There's zero government risk with Moutai. It's so deeply built into like the love that Chinese people have for alcohol. I mean, that is, it's just, it's, I think there's no alcohol that the Western world sees that's an equivalent that we can even wrap our head around. That would be the same way. But I think if you have an understanding for Chinese culture and how much they love it, it just kind of makes sense. And then, Lilu sold, dad sold, he mentioned it to me. I owned it in like a personal account and a couple accounts, and I didn't really have any reason to sell. And I was kind of surprised he was selling, but you know, I think fund managers have, and I see this a lot too, like now that I do it full time or that I'm managing my own, is that there's always an inflow of ideas coming in, and you may want to be like, oh, this one's run its course. Maybe this isn't a good investment anymore. But I mean, Moutai is a moat of all moats and an incredible business. It's really hard to find that business model. And I think it just isn't worth selling something with that strong of a model.
Very cool. And when was this trip roughly?
I want to say December 2017, we made the trip. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just bringing up the Moutai stock out of interest at the moment. So December 2017 was trading at roughly 650, and it's about 1600 today. And is that a stock that you still own, or have you moved on to other stuff at this point?
I still own it. Yeah, I haven't sold anything. Yeah.
Yeah. No plans to sell?
No, I think till I die.
Very cool.
I hope it doesn't get sold after I die.
Yeah. Yeah, that does sound like a lot of Guy Spears kind of rubbed off on you as opposed to your dad. Very cool. Should we maybe jump across to some... Actually, no, there's one other topic I just want to chat through with you before we maybe jump to some Twitter questions, because there's lots of good stuff to talk through there, which is, I guess, your involvement with Dakshana, the foundation that's been set up. Can you speak a little bit to kind of your involvement with that?
Yeah, Dakshana started, I think it was founded when I was 10. So I've kind of grown up with it as in at least teenage years. I see it as an incredible model. I think, I went to Berkeley. I am relatively pretty left and liberal with how I vote. And I really care for like the plight of the working man and how hard it is for how life is for most people. The main reason I actually really loved working at the endowment is because it was investing for a good cause. So I think I've always had I think just nonprofit and good work is always something to kind of admire. But what's really exceptional with Dakshana is how it really is doing good with like a business mindset. We really want the foundation wants to alleviate poverty in the shortest amount of time, best way possible, with and just like make life better for future generations, for smart individuals that aren't given a chance. When Dakshina really started having massive classes, I was younger than the students in the training program. Then I'd visit India and I was their age. Then I got to be a little bit older than them, and there's so many that are about my age that I've kept in touch with. And I think around the time I was like 15 or 16, I told my dad that I really don't actually I think, and we don't really have any inheritance in place. I don't want an inheritance, but all I really want is the foundation. And when I was 19, I got the Duxton logo actually tattooed on my back. I think he especially really likes that. I don't think he likes that I have a tattoo, but I think if it's I'm gonna get a tattoo, it's probably the one he'll hate the least. And I've been pretty involved as an adult. I think my role title is Vice President of Strategy. And the plan at the moment is that when he passes away, I would take over as chairwoman. But I spend a lot of time working with the operators on the there. I run a lot of initiatives to try and we have too much money in Dakshina to try and use that money for more good and try small pilot programs out. So we've worked with Khan Academy, we've considered coding boot camps, and that kind of all runs under me with, and I have a man on the ground that I usually work with. And it's kind of just been a lot of fun to try and figure out new models that will work on a small scale using a business mindset. And what I really appreciate about being the vice president of strategy for Dakshina is I really learn how to, I mean, we have a lot of money, but we're not going to waste it. And so we really try it on projects that we think will work. And if we shut the program down, like we've still done some good for like a lot of people. So it's just, I've really enjoyed Dakshina is probably something that'll be a big part of my life going forward. And
Very
it
cool.
has brought me back to India so many more times. So it's been kind of fun for me.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I think Dakshina is a very cool initiative. Something I haven't shared too much on my YouTube channel, but something that's quite close to my heart. There's actually a school here in New Zealand called Dilworth School, which I was lucky enough to go to, which actually follows kind of a similar model to Dakshina in many ways, although far less efficient. There was, I think, £100,000 before the New Zealand dollar was a thing, and like in 1906, I think Dilworth School was started, and essentially that money has been like reinvested for a long period of time to where they've got, I think, something like $1 billion in net worth in New Zealand dollars, and that money is basically funneled directly towards educating students and kind of in rough circumstances, basically. So my dad had like a farm accident, for example, ended up actually losing an arm. And I got the opportunity to go to Dilworth and get a great education and that sort of thing. And I think Dakshina seems kind of like Dilworth here in New Zealand, but on serious steroids. And and like being able to educate students for like really modest amounts of money, I think it's really incredible initiative.
Yeah, and the campuses we have, I mean the teachers are great that we hire, but the teachers actually love teaching this group of students because if they teach, a bunch of rich kids in an urban area, they're lucky if they get one kid into IIT. And when they teach these kids, like a way larger percentage get in. And the kids, to their credit, they work really hard. I mean, they study really hard. Those 2 years, I've talked to so many graduates after, and they say those 2 years were the hardest. They worked their whole life. And I think just being 16, 17, 18, 19, and grinding that hard and kind of carrying your family pressure, it's a lot for them. And I think like they should be commended for their effort too, because it is so hard. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess just speaking from my own, I'm sure a less extreme experience than what a lot of these kids kind of come up through. It's quite a cool thing to be involved with when like all of your peers around you come from, similarly tough circumstances, I guess. I find that that really bonds people.
Yeah,
Yeah, for sure.
it is awesome.
Cool. Well, should we jump over to some Twitter questions? We were just chatting before that we've got a lot of them. So
Of
we'll see what
course.
we can get through. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely.
Right. Let's have a look through. So, why Drew? Where'd the name of the fund come from?
So I've only ever had one investor actually guess correctly. And it kind of blew me away that she figured it out so fast. But it's actually because I like Nancy Drew. I read every single Nancy Drew book when I was 9 years old, at least whatever I could find at the library. And I would actually read the first chapter and then the last chapter, and then I would kind of solve the mystery with Nancy. And I don't know, I liked her. She was the right amount of feminine, the right amount of smart, the right amount of analytical and intuitive and observant. And a lot of what investing is kind of in like investigative journalism and sleuthing. So it's just kind of a tribute to her.
Very cool. I would never have guessed that. That's good to know. We've got another one here from Rohan. What are some lessons that you've learned from your father? Is there anything that you try to avoid from his investing style?
I mean, the main lesson that he really instilled in both my sister and I growing up is no self-pity, no envy, which has carried over in a bunch of ways. And I think that specifically comes from Munger. And in terms of investing from him, like mistakes that I think he's made, I think if management is really excited to talk to you and they kind of call you out of the blue often, that is a huge red flag for me. I saw that growing up with one of his holdings and it kind of blow up. And then when I was at Dalton, there was a company we were invested in where the CEO called us, I mean, middle of the night, his time in India, so daytime, our time in the US, and kind of kept asking us to buy more shares. The moment that happens, you should sell everything. And that's exactly what we did. And we actually made it out okay. So I think it's exciting as a manager, investment manager, when management really likes you and really wants to talk to you. But you should be very wary, is probably like one lesson I figured out. And that's really in, something for professional investors, I think, will happen often to them.
Very cool. How does your circle of comp? Well, I'm gonna kind of narrow this question down a little bit. But what would you say is your kind of core areas in terms of your circle of competence? What type of companies do you feel really comfortable researching?
I think the with the circle of competence, it's really kind of like the intersecting of mental models. So every time you study a business, you learn something new about how the business world works and some new model and something. And before you realize it, after a few years, they all kind of overlap in a way you wouldn't even have realized. So I'm really comfortable in emerging markets. I think more than most investors in my stage of investing, and I think that's just because I was put in the middle of India for a long time. I mean the amount of fraud, I think my circle of competence with fraud is very good, at identifying fraud is pretty good. It's not flawless, but I'm very skeptical. So I think in fraud it's great. In terms of sectors, I'm completely fine with every single sector. I'm definitely more comfortable with certain ones over others. Financials and consumer spending is just easy. I think something like my dad and I disagree on is that he really hates retail, and I'm really comfortable with retail on which players I like and that I don't like. And I think some of that just comes from being a female investor and just kind of seeing like what kind of spending habits women frequently engage in. So I think with circle of competence, something that is specific to me is that just like a very high awareness of fraud that I think most investors who are in their 20s would not be aware of.
Yeah, a good like BS meter, I guess. BS radar, I suppose. Where do you think you got that from?
Investing in India,
Right.
there's a lot of fraud. Yeah, there's so much fraud. And it's kind of sad being ethnically Indian and seeing it all the time, but I'm just happy to be aware of it and kind of avoid it as much as possible.
Yeah, I like it. What else have we got here? How do you approach calculating intrinsic value?
So I really like that question on Twitter. First, your video on intrinsic value is very good for anyone that wants to kind of get started on it. I think you do a very good job. But I think with most companies, you can get to a liquidation value, which is like the low end or the floor number, which is really isn't applicable in most cases. And then intrinsic value truly is hard to calculate. For most really good businesses, it would be many times liquidation value. So if you look at something like Berkshire Hathaway, I think both Warren and Charlie, their intrinsic value is actually different from each other, but it really wouldn't be that far off from each other. And then if you did an intrinsic value of Berkshire 50 years ago when it was $40 a share, any number would have been way too low. So I think what I really care about is the DNA of the business, and you really want to do kind of destination analysis and where can this business be in like realistically 3-5 years, ideally 10, 20 years. I really don't want to sell. I just do not want to sell something that I buy. Of course, there will be a million reasons and I will end up selling, but I don't want to buy something knowing that I'm going to sell it someday. So I think it's good to, I think with the intrinsic values, it's just good to have a sanity check that you're not buying something that's outrageously valued.
Yeah, for sure. And what's that process usually look like for you? Do you follow the commandment of thou shalt not use Excel, or is that?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't even have Excel on my computer until like a few months ago. I was literally using Google Sheets, which I think is horrific to anyone that's listening. It's really simple math. But I would say what you do in your intrinsic value is simple math. And is just, it really shouldn't be like a massive Excel spreadsheet. Of course, it's kind of fun to build it out. And I think but the problem is like the more variables you have, the more different the number can look. And you can make it look whatever way you want. Really, you have to think critically on what makes sense.
Yeah, agreed. You can make anything happen in a spreadsheet if you make enough outrageous assumptions, I guess.
I can make Tesla make sense. You know, I can make Tesla at the value I want.
What's your hot take on Tesla?
You know, I actually, 2015, I had like 10 shares of Tesla, and I was sitting in my dad's annual meeting, and he gave like a 7-minute presentation on why Tesla's valuation doesn't make sense. And I think I put the sell order right then. So I've actually owned the share. I've owned it for a short amount of time. I got out. I think what they're doing for the world is great. I think I don't own a Tesla. I don't even have a car, but they're fun to hang out in. And if you value it like a car company, then yeah, the valuation doesn't make sense. If you value it like a tech company, it could make sense, but it's just something that I would just not touch.
Yeah. Too hard basket.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got another one here from Mission Chief. Do you clone anyone not in the Monash sphere of influence, Munger, Lilu, Guy Spier, etc.?
Oh yeah, everyone on dataroma.com I look at. There are a lot of investors that I really like whose letters I try to get my hands on. In New York, if you've seen Girish Bhaku, he's a little bit more tech focused than I would like, but he's holding on strong. And he has incredible notes on like kind of value cycles and applying it. And I mean, the businesses he buys are good businesses, but I think they're just not prices I would want to buy them at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, so that's one person. Yeah, and then I actually really like Einhorn for a long time. So Dillard's idea in 2015 actually came from Einhorn.
Right. What is it about David Einhorn that you like?
I just like, I don't like the Netflix short because I don't like shorting. Thou shall not short is definitely something that everyone with investing with their own money or other people's money should follow. But I think I've just looked at his holdings since 2013, 2014. And it's made more sense to me than some other portfolios for a long time. So this is actually a great thing that anyone that wants to learn how to invest well should do is every time the 13 EVs come out, specifically I go to dataroma.com, I look at what was bought that quarter in the top 10 or 15 holdings for an investor. It's usually a really high conviction idea. Go look at like all over the internet for what is the investment thesis here. It's probably something close to what that investor is thinking. It's probably not too different from that. And then you can kind of think, okay, this is what's happening. This is what they care about. This is something I should care about. How does this make sense to me? Am I comfortable with it? And then is there anywhere else I can find this kind of idea out in while investing? And so that's kind of been a really fun way to build my mental models. And Einhorn has been one of the people I've looked at a lot.
Very
It's
cool.
just, yeah, I
We've already covered investing style a little bit, but we've got a question here on, I guess whether you're open to investing in like Graham style cigar butts. Do you tend to stick to Munger style wonderful businesses or a bit of a mix of both?
I definitely lean Munger Beautiful Businesses more than cigar butts. And I get this critique a lot that with my fund being small in size, I really should be doing more cigar butts, but I'm just not in I'm just not comfortable. I don't know. The downside is just too high sometimes. And I would rather just have a great business. So yeah. I
Is
really
it?
like that one Munger quote. That Graham walks into a candy store every day and finds the cheapest thing, and Munger walks into the candy store price he likes.
Nice. Is it like the is it the getting caught up in, you know, weird, really cyclical stuff and that type of thing that turns you off from the cigar butts?
Yeah, I think for me it just the downside is just too high, in my opinion. But I think what, how do I explain this? I think when you work in emerging markets, you can get really great businesses for cheap prices just because there's more inefficiency there. So I almost want to call it like a Munger in emerging market kind of framework is what I follow.
Yeah, cool. We've got a couple of questions here. I guess this has been a hot question for the last year or so, but just kind of general thoughts on on Chinese tech. Like I know you've got obviously the Moutai investment in China. And you mentioned before actually around regulatory risk, and you view that quite different for something like Moutai versus other Chinese businesses. Do you have any general thoughts you want to share on some of those other companies, Alibabas and Tencents of the world?
Yeah, so I think with at least my take on Chinese regulation is there's three things regulators care about. Is it good for the people? Is it good for national strength? And is it good for GDP? And I think that's a great framework to apply to businesses, especially Chinese tech businesses when they when looking at them. And it's a little bit obvious of where Tencent and Alibaba lie. I would say both are pretty unfairly beaten down right now. But Tencent is a lot smarter than Alibaba when it comes to kind of how the CCP and the regulator thinks about their businesses. And I think it's just that Tencent is 100% digital. It would take 2 minutes for the CCP to say no more Tencent. And they are very aware of that.
Right.
So that's about as much as I would say, but yeah.
Yeah. So you think Tencent being a little more proactive than an Alibaba because they're more aware of that risk?
Yeah, but both businesses are excellent. And I think Alibaba has a lot more competitors coming into the space. And Tencent has probably a better DNA with just how when they make their investments in the digital space and they launch new products in the digital space, it's a higher return and a higher impact that kind of comes to the bottom line faster. So I like Tencent for that, yeah.
Yeah, cool. We've got a another question here on, I guess, the Munger never sell type approach. Since you're a fan of never selling, I'd like to hear your thoughts behind holding companies when others are selling. They did say in this comment, especially her dad, but we can ignore that part if you like. I guess how does people selling stocks that you own influence your thinking, if at all?
So I think when I notice like fund managers selling, my first assumption is maybe they got a massive redemption, maybe they found something better, Maybe they're just not comfortable holding it anymore. And for kind of, I think I like to think about, is there something I'm missing? And so I'll do like, you'll do like another round of analysis to see, is like, did I miss something? Am I not thinking about this properly? And that's kind of about it. But yeah, in my personal investing, what's happened is every time I've had income, I've just bought more stock, and I haven't really sold anything to buy anything new, because there's always kind of like a flow of money coming in.
Yeah.
And then with the fund, I just have such a large cash position that I also haven't really had reason to sell recently, but I'm sure when I'm, you know, more deployed, it may be different, but I'm hoping it won't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool.
But really, I think when you see a big redemption, my assumption is it's just probably some redemption or something coming in for a fund manager.
Yeah, nice. I often say it's like, it's one thing to clone the idea, but it's an entirely different thing to clone the conviction. And yeah, it's going to be really tough if you buy a stock and it gets cut in half or something, and you purely just bought it because someone else bought it, and you don't actually understand the business. And I guess the same is true when you see people sell.
Yeah. You should always do your own homework. But it's, you know, in the beginning, it's hard to do your own homework because it sometimes just doesn't make that much sense. But the more and more, honestly, the more you read and the more you go through the exercise of why did they buy? Why did they buy? Why did they buy? Then when it comes to why do they sell, you're like, you know, maybe they made a mistake, or okay, maybe this is something I should think about. But I would not just automatically sell because you see an investor selling something.
Yeah, agreed. This is an interesting one. How do you make good investing decisions during stressful times?
Oh, I think I have a really high tolerance for pain. I'm pretty unbothered by what's going on. And I honestly I do credit that to my dad, just watching him kind of be pretty good about that and just get better and better with time. I mean, literally, I've seen him just invest since I was 4 or 5 years old. So I think since I was 8, 9 years old, I could really see like market cycles, timing with his, how he behaves. And he's very consistent. And I think that's just like, that's probably somewhere he's been a great role model, where I've also just kind of embodied that, where like, you know, you see a bunch of stuff going on in the market, you know, you have to stay calm. You have to stay calm and look at it logically and rationally. So if that means, you know, stepping away for like a day or two and taking your time and just letting it sink in, that's totally fine too. And then like, I think the style of investing we do, we're not trading that frequently. So if it's really confusing, don't act. Just, you know, stay still, think about it, like breathe through it, read research that's coming online, because that will come out faster than, and kind of help develop your thinking too. And the one thing that I think that like sticks with me pretty well is Fidelity has that study of all their accounts, and the accounts that perform the best were the ones where the account holders had died. Just act dead. Just, you know, these people's accounts have walked through so many market cycles. If you don't know what to do, don't act. Just, you know, take a breather and then come back to the question. And probably what's happening is you should get cash, find cash, put it to work, or look at each idea and think, okay, you should test each idea against what's happening. So the pandemic was a really exciting time. And what happened. And something that immediately came to mind with me is there's this idea of the lipstick effect, started by, I think, Leonard Lauder. And the idea is that like women in times of recession stop buying fancy fur coats and fancy handbags, but will buy smaller luxury items in like price. The price is less, but it'll be something like a lipstick or an eyeshadow or an eyeliner or like a blush or whatever it is. And it like be like a Dior eyeliner or something. And so what you see is, and you can actually look at this in Louis Vuitton's 2007 to 2010, specifically their selective retailing section of their revenue, is incredible growth in recession times. And so Louis Vuitton is always known as like the anti-recession company, but it's because you see like huge flows of capital to eyeliner and lipstick. And so something like a Walgreens, a CVS, an Ulta, Sephora's owned by Louis Vuitton, would do incredibly well in a recession. And I saw so many value investors selling those businesses. And I was like, oh my God, you do not understand women if you're selling these things. In the pandemic, they're going to be doing their nails at home, everything at home. They're going to be shopping more and more. And that just like didn't register with like 90% of the male investors out there. So I think you really have to like just take the time to breathe and read through like past cycles and see like what worked, what didn't work. Try to apply that.
Yeah, cool. And are there any processes that you have in place, like investment checklists or anything like that, to try and keep thinking rationally through those times?
Sorry, you cut out a little bit on that question. What was the
Yeah,
last sentence?
I was just saying, are there any sort of processes like investment checklists or anything that you have in place to try and stay rational through stressful times or volatile markets?
Yeah, so I have a checklist. I think it's about 200 questions that I run through, and it's not applicable to every name, but it's something I always look at before I make an investment. So there are a bunch of like recession time questions on there, but there's nothing different I do during a recession other than, if you're following the Munger method, you kind of already have the list of like 30 companies that you would buy when they get to a certain price. And when you see them get there, you need to have the guts to just pull the trigger on it. There's no name I invest in that I don't run across my checklist. So it's just like the same checklist I've developed. But yeah. For example, something like Moutai would be very exciting to buy in a recession time. Like, I don't care. I'm just gonna buy it. You just have to do it. Yeah.
Cool. This is an interesting one. What did it take to start a fund? Can you speak to what actually goes into getting a fund off the ground?
Yeah. So a hedge fund can be $1 million, $100 million, and whatever $1 billion. It's whatever capital you feel comfortable running. It can be just your own. It can be friends and family. You can go to endowments and try raising there. But really, it's just you need to have a couple investors that will probably stick with you through a certain amount of time before pulling capital out so you can stay afloat. The moment you can find that, it's probably a great time to launch. I would say there's actually more administrative things that are kind of hard to get down in the first 6 to 9 months, and then you kind of just have it. So you have like, a third party administrator, a clearing bank, a brokerage, probably an auditor, and a legal and compliance team. And once you have kind of all that set up and they all know how to talk to each other and talk to you, it's kind of easy just to keep running. It's kind of like you're just making trades on your own brokerage account. And so I think about my fund as if it's my own personal money. And even when I write letters to my investors, I do what Buffett does. I write it to my sister and I take out her name and I change it out with partners. And I would say, like, really, you just need capital that will not leave and whatever size you want. If that's 1 million, I think Dad started with 1 million. I started with 2 million. I did not raise a massive fund in the beginning. And the one thing with a hedge fund is it's not like a closed fund where you have to raise, close the fund, and then allocate it. You can have money come in continuously. And that's kind of how I have it structured. So every quarter, money comes in, and one day of the year, money goes out.
And you're running a 0625 model from memory as well, is that correct?
I am running a 0625, yes.
How was that an easy decision? How'd you land on that kind of fee structure?
I mean that was never something that was probably up for debate with myself. I think I've just seen it work well for my dad. It actually is probably the best fee structure for the limited partner, for all the people that are investing in it, because and with the high watermark and everything, you're not robbing them of their money and you're not just taking money for holding it. You really want to make that return for them. And my money is in both of my funds. And so I'm invested alongside them, and I just think of the whole thing as my money, and I just want to do good by them. So I think it's just the incentive is correct for the manager and the limited partner. I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think it incentivizes you to not lose investor money. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems about as well aligned as anything I've ever come across. So it is cool to see more and more people kind of taking up that structure. Let's maybe do one last question. So this is from Finding Compounders on Twitter. If you only had 5 minutes to analyze a business, what would be some of the first things that you look at?
Yeah, so in the first 5 minutes of learning about a company, I've probably already pulled up the 10K and the Value Investor Club write-up. And I'm really looking at high returns on equity. I'm looking at what their leverage profile looks like. If I'm thinking about the business model, it's how long is this runway, and what's their ability to grow. But those are the first two things I specifically look at.
Mm-hmm.
And then in foreign markets, you do not have Value Investor Club. So I'm usually somewhere on the internet in some weird hole looking at something.
And,
or I'm contacting one of my contacts in one of those countries to try and set up a call to talk about it.
Yeah, cool. And does valuation come into it that early? Like, are you someone that would dismiss a company immediately because it's trading at 40 times earnings or something? Like, you just wouldn't even bother looking at it? Or is that something you ignore initially?
No, I would, you know, yeah, I think I don't ignore if it's, I mean, unless it's like really grotesque, I'm not going to pass on it, because with every business you study, you learn something. And for example, I was looking at Shopify, and I like the business. I don't like the valuation. And so I kind of just like continuing to look at it. But yeah, I don't say no to studying a business just off valuation, because there's always something to learn. And if it's a really good business, you know, one day it might be a price I want. So it's always worth looking at the business model and trying to understand it better.
Yeah, for sure. That's something I definitely need to get better at. I'm probably too quick to just throw a lot of stuff out. But yeah, we all have our flaws.
Yeah.
Monsoon, I really appreciate you taking the time. I know we've been trying to tee this up for a little while, and you said, you know, you'd come on this podcast first before any others, and sounds like you got a couple back to back now. So I really appreciate you taking the time. For those that are keen to kind of follow along with what you're doing, I know you're somewhat active on Twitter. Where can people go to follow what you're up to and the fund as well, if you want to plug that?
I think Twitter, and then just the website for the fund, drewinvestments.com. There's some information out there that we're allowed to put out to the public domain. But really, I think Twitter is a great place. And Tom, thank you so much for having me and being patient with me for my very first podcast. It's very exciting to do this, and especially with you.
No, this has been great. We'll have to do this again soon. And I will link all of that in the description below for anyone listening in that's interested.
Thank you.
Cool. Thanks very much.